Then let us begin. Week 3, Hannah, or Hannah as she's written on the sheet, same person. Anybody know the association between Hannah and Rosh Hashanah? Sorry? Prayer? Well, that's true in terms of content, but even before you get to content, what is the association between the story of Hannah? Hannah, not Sarah. Yes, Mordechai. The Haftarah, correct. The traditional Haftarah read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah is the story that we are going to be reading today from the beginning of the book of Samuel. It is the story of Hannah. And why that's so, why we choose it for Rosh Hashanah, I hope will become clear in the course of the next hour. But as an icebreaker for this, just to get us into this, I wanted to show you source number one. A favorite quote of mine from Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, professor of history at Columbia University. Passed away a few years ago. He said, "There is an inherent tension in modern Jewish historiography, as in the study of history." Because why say history if you can say historiography? There's an inherent tension in modern Jewish historiography, even though most often it is not felt on the surface nor even acknowledged. To the degree that this historiography is indeed modern and demands to be taken seriously, it must, at least functionally, repudiate premises that were basic to all Jewish conceptions of history in the past. Okay? To the extent that the study of history is modern, it has to repudiate, at least on a functional level, meaning the way you operate as opposed to the way you think, but on a functional level, it must reject premises that were always basic to the way that Jews looked at history. There is something different, some way in which Jewish history and the modern study of history are different. Stephen.
Modern history is history. Slash. Jewish history is experience.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's shortchanging history. Meaning, I don't think Jews invented the idea that history is about experience. Also, the facts are also experience. I am looking for something a little different. Yes?
Modern historians might discount the fact that God played a role in Jewish history, whereas the study of history moves way back to it and is presupposing.
Right. Jewish history looks at history with God moving things along. Whereas modern history adamantly says that there is no such thing as a mover of history. Events simply take place. And there is cause and effect, but God is not among the causes. Right? Sandy may remember this. The first class that we did here at Beth Emeth was the Melton course on history, and we talked about this as a theme back then. If you continue reading what Yerushalmi writes, he says, "In effect, it must stand in sharp opposition to its own subject matter. The study of Jewish history opposes the concept of Jewish history, not on this or that detail, but concerning the vital core, the belief that divine providence is not only an ultimate, but an active causal factor in Jewish history, and the related belief in the uniqueness of Jewish history itself." In other words, what Yerushalmi is trying to say is that when the modern historian looks at the world and pick an event, any event, it doesn't matter, there is no value to a particular event. Events are not good. They are not bad. They do not serve a purpose. They simply are. Name the event, it won't matter. Not a war, not a famine, not a stock market crash, not an expulsion, and I'm picking for some reason all the negatives, but not new discoveries, not new inventions, exploring, none of those things are good or bad. They are the result of events that preceded them. They will trigger events that come after them, but it's simply the flow of events. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. Within the secular view of history, there is no sense of purpose. There's no such thing, really, as progress, because there's no goal. There's no vision of, we are moving towards a particular end. Once we say that there is some kind of a goal to history, that we're trying to achieve something, even something that's not a religious goal, but just a general goal, society is moving towards supporting all of its citizens. The idea that history is moving towards a goal of tolerance, you're imposing something on events which don't really work that way. From a secular historical perspective, things happen, and the job of the historian is not to say good or bad. The job of the historian is to explain, to the extent possible, why this led to that, and potentially to project, and therefore this is what's going to happen next. That's it. From a Jewish history perspective, it's completely different. The mover of everything is God. There is a goal of, as we say traditionally in prayer, L'takein olam b'malchut shakai, to improve the world under the reign of God. There is a vision of religious growth and spiritual growth for all humanity. The idea certainly of a Mashiach, a messianic time. Those all suggest that there is a purpose to things, and that there is a God who may choose to intervene or not intervene, manipulate or not manipulate, but it's all part of some kind of plan. Diane.
When you talk about Jewish history, are you talking about Tanakh?
So, when I talk about Jewish history, I suppose what I really ought to say is the Jewish view of history, because history is all human history. Even pre-human, I suppose. In other words, when I say Jewish history, what I mean is the study of history from a Jewish perspective.
Even like medieval
times. Medieval times, our own day. Yeah, everything that has happened is a historical event, and Judaism will look at it and say, from a Jewish history perspective, there must have been a purpose. It's not, let me put it this way. When I use the term Jewish history, I don't mean the history of Jews. I mean a Jewish way to look at the history of events. That's the, I think that's what I'm trying to suggest. How does this relate to Rosh Hashanah? Because it does.
New beginnings.
New beginnings. How does this concept that he's putting forth, the idea of progress towards a goal in history, relate to Rosh Hashanah? What is Rosh Hashanah supposed to mark? Yeah?
Reflection on our past year of action and looking forward to improving in the future.
Okay, how would that connect, though, to Yerushalmi's quote? You're right, but how would that connect to the quote from Yerushalmi? Or doesn't it? Maybe it doesn't. I think it does, but... What is the first Rosh Hashanah? What's the first Rosh Hashanah in history? Creation. Right? Creation of what? Don't say the world. It's not true. Creation of human beings. Right? Phase 6. Day 6 of creation is the creation of human beings. That's what's supposed to be on Rosh Hashanah. When the traditional liturgy says, on Rosh Hashanah, Hayom Harat Olam, today is the conception of the world, it's actually the conception of human beings. Rosh Hashanah as the day marking creation of humanity is a day that claims that God is involved with the world. Once you make the statement that God created, and you don't need to go into conversations about whether it was 15 billion years or whether it's 5,777 years, that's not germane to this point. Once you claim that God created, you're already positing divine involvement with the world. The secular historian says, get God out of there. Why is it that there are people? Because there were cells, and the cells came from a comet, or the cells came from lightning striking a set of chemicals, or whatever it was. But no, there's no vision There's no purpose, there's no plan, it simply was. And the Jewish view of history, as expressed by Rosh Hashanah, says, no, there's a creator. And not only that, but as we're going to see in the story that we're going to discuss today, since Rosh Hashanah is also supposed to be this day of judgment, when you look back at what happened in the past year, and ask what was good, what was bad, what do we keep, what do we throw out, and so forth. And when God is assessing, that suggests not only a God who cared at some point, but who continues to care, who continues to be involved. That's that's exactly what Yerushalmi here in source number one has a problem with. He's a believer in the Jewish view of history, but the practice of his profession says you don't do that. The practice of his profession says, leave God out of this. So what we're going to see today, I hope, is the story of Hannah and her song. It's not going to be about the themes we discussed with Joel and with Jonah, where we talked about sin and redemption. What this is going to talk about is this God who cares about what happens and how one speaks to such a God. So we need, in order to get there, we need to start with the basic story of Hannah. I apologize to those who know the story already, but we just need to get the basics down. In source number two, I brought you the translation of the first chapter in Samuel. The edition that I used was a JPS edition of it. It came with all the V's and the thou's and hasks and whatnots, and I tried to edit those out. Probably missed a few, but I tried to turn it into English. So, yeah. Now there was a certain man of Ramatayim Tzofim, of the hill country of Ephraim. Just frame of reference for people, hill country of Ephraim, Har Ephraim in Hebrew, is in central Israel. It is the scene of many of the most important events found in Tanakh. In the prophets, you find many things happening on Mount Ephraim. This is the hill country of Ephraim. His name was Elkanah, the son of Yerucham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Tzuf, from the tribe of Ephraim. Hence living in the hill country of Ephraim. The fact that you get his lineage here suggests something's important here, right? There's something we want to know that's coming out of this story. We need to know someone's lineage in this story. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city from year to year to worship and to sacrifice to God, to the God of hosts, in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were there. They're in Shiloh. They act as priests of God. This is before there's a temple in Jerusalem. You have instead a temple in the city of Shiloh. And it came to pass, upon a day when Elkanah sacrificed, that he gave to Peninnah his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters, portions, right, portions of the sacrifice. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But God had shut up her womb. A familiar story from Tanakh. Who else in Tanakh is like this? Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca, right? The great matriarchs, with the exception of Leah, all had trouble having children. So Hannah is in the same boat. And he loves Hannah. He feels terrible at her situation. He tries to make it up to her the way a man would. He says, here, have a double portion of dinner. And her rival greatly angered her to make her thunder. Now, that's my adjustment of the translation. Because it's an important word, and I'm doing it based on the way the sages read the word. The word in Hebrew is ba'avur har'imah. For the Hebrew speakers, it's hey, resh, ayin, yud, mem, hey, would be the way you would write it. Har'imah, from the word ram. Anybody know what ram is in Hebrew? Thunder. Right, ram, ramim, is thunder. Peninnah wants to anger Hannah. She needles Hannah over the fact that she, Penina, has kids and Chana doesn't. That's a terrible human being. Why do you name anybody Penina anymore? After this story, what? How do we understand the motivation of what Penina is doing? Jealous because Elkanah favors her. That's one way to look at it. How else could you look at it? Protecting her birthright? How is it going to protect her birthright, though?
Well, she has control whether she'll have children or not.
The other way to look at it, the sages try to find a positive way to understand what Penina did. And they suggest that what she's trying to do is to move Chana to pray more forcefully to God. Because if you'll really pray, maybe it'll work. I can tell from the moans that people aren't buying it. But that's the idea, to make her thunder, meaning to make her thunder before God. Okay. Judging others favorably is a good trait. In any case, she needles Chana. And as he did so year by year, he, Elkanah, when she went up to the house of God, so she, Penina, angered her. Every time they went to the temple, it was the same story. That's one of the ways that, that's one of the points that the sages read in this. Meaning, why assume that it's about prayer? Because specifically, Penina does this to her at the time when they're going to the temple. So that suggests that there's a relationship there. And the relationship may be she wants to get her to pray. Maybe. But therefore she wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, this is another classic male line, Chana, why do you weep? Why don't you eat? Why is your heart grieved? Am not I better to you than 10 sons? Am I not enough? That's the that's his statement to her. He's trying in defense of my species. What is he able to do? What is he supposed to do? He can't take back the fact that he has children and that he has children with the other wife. He tries to show that he loves her. He gives her the extra portion, and he says, "Let our relationship be sufficient. What else am I supposed to do?" He's doing his best to try to make her feel better, but it's not working. So Chana rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon his seat by the doorpost of the temple of God. And she, Chana, was a bitter spirit. And she prayed to God and wept greatly. And she vowed a vow and said, O God, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me and not forget your handmaid, but will give your handmaid a man-child, son, that's a good translation, then I will give him to God all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. What's the razor reference? A Nazarite, correct, to be a Nazir, which the Torah records as a measure of somebody who, for whatever reason, wants to achieve greater piety. So they would take on vows. The Nazir vows to refrain from 3 things, right? One is cutting his hair. One is drinking grape products, wine, grape juice, etc. And the other, not going into a cemetery, not coming in contact with the dead. Separation from all 3 of these things. Why that achieves greater piety is a good question, but not for right now. But the image is of somebody who is essentially an ascetic. They stay away from other people. They stay away from the society of others. They're not going to drink. They're not going to cut their hair. The image of not cutting one's hair is not that you get long, luxurious locks. The idea is that you look wild and unkempt. You're not somebody who people want to be around. That's the image. So she says, if I have a kid, I just want a kid. I want to bring life into this world. I'm not going to keep him for myself. I'll dedicate him to you, God. I will give him to you. He will be a Nazir. And giving him to God, as we're going to see, is even more than that. And it came to pass, as she prayed long before God, that Eli watched her mouth. He's watching her pray. Now Hannah spoke in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice could not be heard. Right? You can imagine. She is somebody expressing such great pain, she doesn't have the strength to voice it aloud. She's making words with her mouth, but he can't hear her. And he doesn't necessarily know the whole story. He's the high priest for the nation. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people come to this temple. And he sees this woman sitting there. And it's after the feast is over, when everybody's been eating and drinking. And he sees her crying, and her mouth is forming words, but nothing is coming out. What's the assumption he makes? She's drunk. Therefore, Eli thought she had been intoxicated. And Eli said to her, "How long will you be intoxicated? Put away your wine." And Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I poured out my soul before God. Count not your handmaid for a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and my anger have I spoken until now." She says it's emotion that's driving this. I'm not drunk. I didn't have anything. Then Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." He says, in that case, may God grant your wish. Whatever it is that you are looking for, may God give it to you. And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. She cheered up. Not cheered up, I imagine, in the sense of, oh, problem solved, but in the sense that she got a blessing from the high priest that God should accept her prayer, and she felt a little bit better as a result of that. And they rose up in the morning early and worshipped before God and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, knew biblical knowing somebody intimacy. And God remembered her. Hence, the major reason to read this on Rosh Hashanah, God remembering her, answering her prayer, as we're going to see. Sheila.
What I found interesting is that she didn't just ask for a child, she asked for a male child.
Yep, she asked for a son. She did not just ask for a child. Why would that be?
So she could send him to God.
Historically, whether you like it or not, whether you feel comfortable or not with it, historically, the male child was considered to bring greater fortune to the family. Why is that? No. It has nothing to do with chattel. It's economic reality. Who is it who's going to go to work? Who is it who's going to do all the manual labor things in the fields? When you raise your daughter and you marry your daughter off to somebody else, she becomes part of their family. When you raise a son, the son is the one who manages the fields, takes care of the animals and all of that. He is going to bring a wife into the family. He's not going to another family. That was simply the way the world worked. Having a son was considered to be fortuitous. That doesn't mean, and I want to stress it, the Talmud makes the point of it, it was considered good for the family to have daughters. The Talmud talks about how you're so much better off if your first child is a daughter than if your first child is a son. But once again, it's a pragmatic consideration. It's because if your first child is a daughter, what's she going to do? Help look after the next 10 kids. That's the idea. It was all pragmatic. It was a very practical thing. It's not just Jews. It's every society that was around then recognized that the male was going to be the one who was going to be the economic driver of the family. That was just the system. So yes, having a male in that sense may have been considered better, but also the fact that she wants him to go work in the Mishkan, in the temple, and that's also a male province, which we can discuss another time, but I'm so not going there right now. Okay. Hannah is pained by Peninnah, who wants to make her thunder. How does Hannah respond? How does Hannah respond to being made to thunder? She prays. How does she pray?
Quietly.
Silently. Doesn't make a sound. She doesn't thunder. She's mute. Not mute in the sense of not expressive. She's expressing thoughts, but she's not saying a word. And this is where I wanted to go with this to start us off. 20 minutes in. Is it better to pray out loud or to pray in silence? Who says praying out loud is better?
I think they're the same.
The same?
Yes, because in Shul we're told to pray out loud.
Yeah. Right. So one approach is that it's better to pray silently to avoid distracting others. The Talmud in Brachot says, better not to distract the people around you. That, you know, that includes having conversations, by the way. But the Talmud says, yeah, pray quietly to avoid distracting others. It also offers other reasons to pray silently, such as you demonstrate trust that God can hear you. You don't need to say it out loud in order for God to know what you're saying. If a person is praying, especially on Yom Kippur, and they're actually stating what they've done wrong in the course of the year, you don't really want your neighbor to know. So from that perspective, it's a good idea to do so quietly. On the other hand, there are reasons to pray out loud. The Mishnah Berurah, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, wrote a work of Jewish law in the beginning of the 20th century, and it's a classic. It's called Mishnah Berurah. Says sometimes it's easier to focus when you express your words out loud, right? When you hear yourself, and when you're forced to actually state something in a coherent way, that can be more meaningful. And then there's a line from the Zohar, that classic work of mysticism, which says it can be cathartic to pray out loud. You know, to actually express what you're feeling in an audible way. There are all sorts of reasons to go one way or the other. Take a look at source number 3, please. Passage out of the Talmud. Rav Hemnuna said, how many mighty laws we can learn from the verses of Chana. We learn how to pray from Chana. Much of what we do is based in her approach to prayer. And here you get 3 examples. The verse says, Chana spoke upon her heart. From which we learn, we see that one who prays must focus his heart. You have to have proper concentration. Just saying the words without thinking about it, without feeling it, is not prayer. Only her lips moved. We see that one who prays must form words with his lips, meaning that you actually say words and not simply think things. There's value to forming words. And then third, her voice was not heard. We see that one may not elevate his voice in prayer, that we are supposed to pray silently. So writes the Talmud, because Chana did it, therefore we do it. We know that it worked for her, so that's a good reason. But take a look at source number 4, where the Zohar, which I referenced a moment ago, this is a different Zohar passage, says one who prays before his master should not raise his voice in his prayer. One who raises his voice in his prayer will not be heard. You'll be heard by the person next to you, but will not be heard by God. Why? Because prayer is not the voice that is heard, that is out loud, that is audible. And so one need not make his voice audible in his prayer, but pray silently, in the voice that is not audible. This is the prayer that is always accepted. God prefers the prayer that is not audible. Now, we just gave a few reasons. Rhoda, are you going to say?
Then why do we need a chazan in our...
Good. Why do we need a chazan at all?
Where did the chazan come from? I can understand before there was printing that someone would lead service, but...
You betcha. You betcha. So Rhoda asks a good question. This is not the way we pray. We have cantors or choirs or chazanim, whatever, you know, whatever they're called and however they vary in different synagogues. Absolutely true. So what are we supposed to make of that when we're told that the ideal form and the one that's always accepted is the one that is silent? So some of the answers are from what Rhoda already just said. That at one point, pre-printing press, the only person in the shul who had a mafzer was the chazan. He was the only one who had the text. And not just Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but all year round, people didn't necessarily have a text in front of them and didn't know it. And so therefore you needed the cantor, that he's going to be the one The cantor is going to be the one to, I betray my orthodoxy, he is going to be the one. Your mileage may vary. The cantor is going to be the one to say the words out loud, and those who don't know them are going to listen and respond amen, and it will count for them as well. That's the most basic reason for having one. Another reason to have one is to keep everybody unified, so that we're praying as a group. Anybody here ever pray in a traditional Sephardic service? So the traditional Sephardic service, if you got there at the beginning, they actually go around the room with people each leading the paragraphs. First this one does, and then the next one does, and then the next one does, and they go around the room that way with each one leading until they get to Baruch Hu. When they get to the first part where you require everybody to be in unison, then a cantor takes over. Cantor, chazan, leader, takes over, and at that point is serving the purpose of unifying everybody so that they're praying as a unit. And that's a second reason to employ a chazan. But for the individuals, it is supposed to be something that they're doing silently rather than something that they're doing aloud. Mind you, this is a reference to personal prayer. When you get to the sections of prayer that are meant to be communal and said together, then there's nothing wrong with people saying the response out loud and singing it and so forth. This is talking about when I express personally my thoughts, my needs, my thanks. That's really what we're focused on here. So you could look at Hannah's choice of praying silently and say that we model ours on it because it worked for her. We model ours on it because it has practical benefits of not distracting other people and so forth. But I think there's something deeper going on in this theme of silent prayer. And in order to draw it out, I wanted to show you another story from Tanakh, from source number 5. A favorite of mine. Kings 1, chapter 19. The prophet involved in this is Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah. This comes on the heels of the story of Mount Carmel. For anyone who's not familiar with the story of Mount Carmel, this is the Reader's Digest version of it. In the time of Elijah, he lived in the northern kingdom. Remember, the Jews are split between a southern kingdom and a northern kingdom. The northern kingdom is largely idolatrous. Looks like much of the rest of the Middle East in those days. You had coups and assassinations. You had worship of idolatry, in general blending in with the tribes that lived around and among the Jews. And the king is a man by the name of Ahab, and his wife is a woman by the name of Jezebel, correct. And Jezebel is a worshiper of the Canaanite gods, and you find that she imports the worship of Baal, one of the Canaanite gods. Asherah is another of the Canaanite gods. She's not solely responsible. As I said, the nation as a whole at that time up north was in trouble. But she strengthens it. And Elijah at one point says, you know, we're going to have a showdown. Battle of the bands. You take 400 of your priests. Those are priests of the Baal. There were priests of the Asherah initially, but they seem to back out at some point. But you take 400 of your priests, go up Mount Carmel with me. You'll bring an offering, I'll bring an offering. And let's see which one God responds to. Whichever one sends out fire from the heavens, that's the right one. The other one is just misleading people and should get out of Dodge. That's the challenge that Elijah puts in front of them. You've heard the story before? Some of you have heard the story before. Okay. So it's usually read at the Haftarah for Parshat Ki Tisa, if there isn't another reason to do a different Haftarah that week. In any case, they go up the mountain, and the prophets of the Baal start their rituals, and nothing is happening. They cut themselves, they cry out before God. Elijah taunts them. He says, maybe you have to call out louder. Maybe your God is in the washroom. And I'm not kidding, that's in the text. They don't get a response. And you get to the afternoon, and Elijah says, okay, my turn. And he pours water all over the altar, so that no one can claim anything about him having added fire. If anything, it will just make the miracle greater. He drowns the altar in water, prays briefly to God, fire comes down from heaven and consumes the offering. The prophets of the Baal are then on the run. A good chunk of them are actually executed. And Jezebel, the queen, says, I have to turn the tide on this, because what he has done is an insurrection. And so she sets out to kill as many of the prophets who are loyal to God as she can find. She sends out squads. She is murdering all of the prophets of God. Elijah is on the run himself. He has to get away. A young man by the name of Obadiah hides a whole bunch of the prophets who are loyal, but Elijah goes on the run out into the wilderness. He's away for 40 days. And that brings us to the story in source number 5, when he arrives at a mountain called Mount Horeb, better known to us as Mount Sinai. And he came there, to the cave, and he rested there. And the word of God came to him, saying to him, why are you here, Elijah? And he said, I have been zealous for God, master of multitudes, for the children of Israel have left your covenant. They have ruined your altars, they have killed your prophets, and only I remain. And they seek to take my life. That's his complaint. And he said, God said, depart and stand upon the mountain before God. God passed before him. And there was a great and mighty wind before God, breaking mountains and smashing stones. And God was not in the wind. And after the wind came an earthquake. And God was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, and God was not in the fire. And after the fire, a voice, silent, small. And then the story repeats, and God says to Elijah, why are you here, Elijah? And he gives the same exact answer as he gave before. And we'll come back to that. But this voice that's silent and small, in Hebrew, called mamadaka, teaches us a very important lesson. There are all sorts of interpretations of what God was trying to say with this small, silent voice, but I brought you Rashi in the last line in source number 6. Rashi, the classic commentator, says, you know what the voice is? It is called the Mishavchen Bechashai, the voice of those who praise God in silence. That's the voice. What is God trying to say to Elijah with this voice of those who praise God in silence?
I hear.
Maybe. I hear them, I hear you. Right, Elijah, you just launched this big tirade. Right? What was it that he had said? I have been zealous for God, master of multitudes. The children of Israel have left your covenant. They've ruined your altars. They've killed your priests. Only I remain. They want to take my life. He is thundering. Peninnah wanted thunder. This is thunder. He's shouting. As a matter of fact, you are likely familiar with the practice at a bris of setting aside a chair for Elijah. That's a response to Elijah saying that they have left the covenant. The covenant is the brit, the bris, which is manifest when we actually carry on a circumcision. And it's a statement of, you said we've left the covenant, here we are, we're still doing it. That's the idea. So, in terms of this is a rebuke to Elijah. It's a statement to him of, you don't need to shout and scream and thunder and so on. The voice of those who speak in silence is actually more powerful than the screaming. And when God comes back to him after the passage that I quoted here in number 5, when God comes back to Elijah and says, why are you here? And he gives the same response, the same thundering, the same anger and outrage. God says, okay, enough. And he gives Elijah a number of instructions, which are the conclusion of his career. And then he says, now it's time for you to go appoint Elisha, your student. He's going to take over. You're done. You have to learn the lesson of this small voice, those who speak to God in silence. That voice which is superior to the fire, to the earthquake, to the, what was the other one? The wind. This is superior. Why is the silent prayer superior? Because there are things that words can't say. There are things which, once you put them into words, actually lose their power. I actually had a quote in a class I gave on Sunday on a story by Shai Agnon. He talked about the power of music. He said, music is more powerful than words. Because once you put it into words, you lose something. There's something that some things can be expressed in music that you can't do with speech. Heather.
Would it be a thought-provoking idea for humans not to anger,
Oh, yeah. Yes, I mean, we absolutely, as a broader theme, Judaism as a religion is taught in the, one of the major principles is to avoid anger, good luck. But it is absolutely a major tenet. The Talmud in Avodah Zarah says that one who gets angry is as though he has worshipped idols. Which isn't just a random association of worshipping idols is really bad, being angry is that bad. But what makes people angry? What is the cause of anger, generally speaking? Losing control. Elaine.
Somebody victimizing you or on you and hurt your...
Right, somebody did something to me. The universe isn't cooperating with me. Right? Frustration, that's the word. Anger is often an expression of frustration. I wanted X, and what happened instead was Y. And the Talmud is saying, why did you expect that the universe should comply with what you wanted? You think you're God, who also doesn't get the universe apparently to comply. That's another story. Your frustration demonstrates a belief that somehow things are supposed to work to your expectations. Once you get used to the idea that the world doesn't have to make you happy, it becomes a lot easier not to be angry. I say this as though I've mastered it. I can talk a good game. Rhoda, yeah. So, it's very interesting. God expresses anger in the Torah. Generally not at Moshe. Once at Moshe when he keeps refusing going to save the Jews. But there are other times when God absolutely expresses anger. And the commentators generally say not only about anger, but all the emotions that are ascribed to God in the Torah, when God is described as regretting, when God is described as being happy, and so forth. They tend to say that these are anthropomorphisms meant to make it easier for us to relate to God. And they're based on what we perceive. Which is why the Talmud says, every time you see anger for God, you'll notice there's always a particular result. There's a particular punishment. Because what we're reading is, God did this, that's an angry act. That's an act that demonstrates anger. Because you're right, we have a very hard time. If anger is such a terrible thing and such a frailty, then what's God doing? But it's broader, it's about emotions in general. Marlene. So Marlene asked, well, what about turning the other cheek, which we associate with Christianity, generally speaking? So I'll say two things. One is that Judaism does have an idea of not always responding. We have a prohibition against taking revenge and so forth. However, that doesn't mandate that you allow other people to harm you. The fact that I'm not supposed to be able to get angry doesn't mean that I also am not supposed to protect myself. If someone is trying to hurt me, I am well justified in self-defense, and we have the known principle, habala hargachash game lahargo. Someone comes to kill you, get up early to kill him first. Don't do it in anger, but be successful. That's our general tendency. I'm actually going to go further with this now. I see Stephen and a couple of hands, but I want to make sure to get through certain ideas here. I think that's one worthy of more discussion at some point. What Chana does, and what we are trained to do, is to understand that there's more than just words. Even though, when human beings are first created, we're told God breathes into us Ruach Chaim, the spirit of life. And the classic Aramaic commentary to the Torah, going back a couple of thousand years, says that that means a speaking spirit. God gives us the power of speech. We still recognize that speech is limited. And silence can often say more than words could ever say. There's a lot you could say to support this, but I think that's one point that's very important. That's one of the reasons why so many of our hymns, Piyutim, use an alphabetical acrostic. Right? Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, and so on, to say, here are all the letters, God. I can't say everything, but I'm saying all the letters, and you know, you consider it as though I had managed to express what I'm trying to express. That's one, but let's get to the second part, because we're running short on time and there's so much to say. Take a look, please, at source number 6, because Chana is only silent in chapter 1. In chapter 2, she's not silent. After she has a child, and Hannah prayed in source number 6 and said, my heart exalts in God. My horn, a horn is a symbol of pride, is exalted in God. My mouth is enlarged over my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. Now I am able to speak. I was silent before, but now there are words that can express what I am feeling. There is none holy as God, for there is none beside thee. Neither is there any rock, protector, like our God. Multiply not exceedingly proud talk, meaning stop talking so much, she says to others who speak in their pride. Let not arrogance come out of your mouth. This theme carries through, the silence versus praying aloud and speaking aloud. For God is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken. They that stumbled are girded with strength. Those who were powerful get torn down. Those who were weak, they're given strength. They who were full have now hired themselves out for bread. Those who were hungry have ceased to be hungry. And the barren, that's Hannah, has had 7 children. Which it may be a prophetic prediction for herself, or just a statement that now I have children, and she who had many children has languished. God kills, and he brings life. He brings down to the grave, and he brings up. And remember, we discussed previously Tchiyat HaMetim, the vision of the ultimate resurrection of the dead. Notice the order that she uses here. First kills, then brings life. First brings down to the grave, then brings up out of the grave. That's the order. God makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, he also lifts up. He raises the poor out of the dust. He lifts up the needy from the dunghill to make them sit with princes and inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are God's, and he has set the world upon them. He will keep, meaning guard, the feet of his holy ones. But the wicked shall be put to silence in darkness, for not by strength shall man prevail. And again, there's that theme of silence. They who strive with God meaning against God, shall be broken to pieces. Against them will he thunder, again, the thundering, in heaven. God will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed one. There is a ton to say about this song, and we've got about 10 minutes. So I'm going to do the best I can to just show you something about it. First of all, this song is what marks Chana as a prophet, right? I said each week we're talking about a prophet. How do you know Chana is a prophet? Where does she predict the future? Right here, she predicts the future. Source number 7 is the Talmud's statement on it. When she says, my horn is raised up. So, I already told you that literally a horn is a symbol of pride. However, they also used to use the horn, the keren, when they anointed kings. Her son was named Shmuel, Samuel, was the one who anointed the first two kings in Israel. First King Saul and then King David, anointing with the horn. So they take this as her prophetic statement about how there will be an anointing in the future, and it's going to come out of her child. So they take that as a sign of her prophecy. Frankly, there are other elements as well that are seen in it as prophetic. If you take a look at source number 8, Targum Yonatan, an ancient translation into Aramaic, which I rendered here into English, commenting on her song. And Hannah prayed with a divine prophetic spirit. And she said, Shmuel, my son, Samuel, will be a prophet over Israel. In his days they will be redeemed from the hand of the Philistines. Via him miracles and mighty deeds will be performed. And that's all the reversals where the weak become strong. Therefore my heart is strong in the portion God has given me. Also, she says, Haman, son of Yoel, son of my son Shmuel, will arise with his 14 sons to sing with stringed instruments with their Levite brethren, offering praise in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Therefore my horn is raised with the gift God has apportioned for me. Also I praise God for the miraculous punishment which will happen to the Philistines. And that's a longer story about what the Philistines had done to the Jews and what now happens with them. I'm not going to actually go into it because we don't have time for the Philistine story. But the point is that she is seen to be predicting the future, to make prophetic statements about her descendants here in this song. But beyond that, and coming back to our Rosh Hashanah theme, she sees God as proactive in her life. She thanks God for giving her a child. She proclaims to the world that this is from God. It's not just a natural occurrence. This is an answer to my prayers. You know, they have the classic joke about the fellow who's looking for the parking spot. Oh, come on, you do know this one. He's racing around, he's going to be late for his business meeting, he doesn't know what to do. He says to God, God, if only you just make a spot available for me, I will fill in the blank with whatever promise you want him to make. And then suddenly a car pulls out a spot in front of him, and there's a spot. He says, oh, never mind. That's the way people do these things, you know. That's the way they respond. You plead with God for help, and then when help comes, it must have been a natural thing. That wasn't God. You've definitely heard that one, no? Okay. Yeah, okay. So, what she does is when she has a child, she turns to God in thanks. And if you go back for a second to the song, where she says in sentence 3, in source number 6, the sentence number 3, multiply not, the way they translate it is, exceedingly proud talk. The Hebrew is, al tarbu ledaber givoha givoha. Don't increase saying givoha givoha, which gavoha means high up, tall. So they say here, proud talk. But the Midrash says it's not what's going on. What she's saying is, don't say that God is way, way up in the heavens and not paying attention. Because her whole song is about the things that God does, that she perceives around her in the world, that she sees God doing. Don't you tell me God is distant. God is hands-on. Take a look at source number 9, commentary from Don Isaac of Barbanel, the end of the 15th century. He says, one might say that her procreation was natural, not from God, since God is apart from the material and elevated above elevation. He will not supervise and know of lowly matters and not give them his attention. She wished to declare this an entirely incorrect concept. God is holy and apart. As she said, there is none other than you. You're unlike everything. There is no one who is holy other than God. Still, even with that introduction, she says, do not increase your speech of elevation. That's how he translates the exceeding proud talk. You allege that he is elevated above elevation, and so he will not supervise. It is not so. Do not turn to the lies of the philosophers. Do not involve yourselves with their investigations. Let ancient ideas come from your mouths. Speak ancient and true words. God is knowing. He knows all that happens here. All events are weighed by him, meaning that he supervises. He's reading this within what she says in the song. The translation will not exactly match the JPS in number 6, because I'm using a Barbanel's approach there. But his point is that she is trying to make the statement that this was a miracle. This was from God, that God intervened. More explicit is source number 10, the comment from Rabbi David Kimchi, who is, I believe, 13th century France. He says, our view regarding this passage and the entire song is that Hannah said, all of the affairs of this world and all human needs depend upon the hand of the blessed Creator and His will. He supervises groups and individuals and does to them according to His will. Even if it seems to people that God does something which is against their will and desire, they should pray to Him with all of their spirits as I, Hannah, did, and He will fulfill their request and desire in every area of their desire and need. For His supervision below in this world is as it is above. And He goes on. And so that's the vision that she says. Now, it's really important to understand one point which we are not addressing here, but it's the elephant in the room, which is, she's been childless all this time. If you were going to say that the birth is from God, what about the fact that she couldn't have kids in her misery all those years? Right? For every person who is wonderfully happy and rejoicing, there are how many other people who call out to God and are suffering? You can't pretend that this is the only human experience. The only human experience is, I pleaded with God for a child and God gave me one. And that is the job of Jewish philosophy, and that is the job of the Talmud and the Midrash to try to explain how Hannah can actually say this. How can she make that claim? She has known incredible suffering all these years while her co-wife, her rival, has been making her thunder. The point that I see in it is not to pretend that the pain isn't there, and not to pretend that everybody gets answered. But the point is to give credit where you do get what you're looking for. And that's, I think, what Hannah is trying to say. To say, when something good does happen, I do say the thank you. So that, to sum up very briefly, we've said, we saw with Jonah, that Judaism believes in forgiveness and it believes in second chances. We said with Joel that the way to survive judgment, that apocalypse, is by calling in the name of God, which we took to mean emulating divine generosity. God gives and you should give. And now we learn about prayer. The value of silence over words, recognizing that the heart feels that which can't always be expressed out loud. And for people to use that, to draw on that in silent prayer. And number two, the importance of recognizing the positive that God does in our world. And that is another means to working our way through this process of sin and repentance and redemption of Rosh Hashanah. What I want to do next week for the fourth of our topics is talk about the prophet Haggai. And Haggai is a tiny book, only two chapters. I highly recommend reading it ahead if you have the chance to do so, but I will bring it next week, God willing, on the sheets. He is the prophet in the beginning of the Second Temple, and he speaks to a Jewish population that is demoralized, that is depressed, and he offers a remarkable rallying cry, which I think is very relevant for us as we approach Rosh Hashanah. Thank you very much.